Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from the Hyatt Ricky's in Palo Alto. My name is Melinda Thomas, and I'm your chair for this evening. It is my pleasure to introduce our guest speaker, Mr. Gary Hamel. Ranked as one of the top 25 business minds of the 20th century by the Journal of Business Strategy, Professor Hamel has been a driving force in revolutionizing the world of business. As a consultant, he has worked with a broad spectrum of the world's leading companies, including Shell, Nokia, and Ford. He is the chairman and founder of Strategos, an international consulting company dedicated towards helping clients create innovation. His landmark book, Competing for the Future, received critical acclaim by The Economist, Financial Times, and Washington Post, and was named Management Book of the Year by Business Week. Over the past 14 years, Professor Hamel has published 10 articles in the Harvard Business Review, four of which have received the prestigious McKinsey Prize for Excellence. Professor Hamel is also the Thomas S. Murphy Distinguished Research Fellow at Harvard Business School and is a visiting professor of strategic and international management at the London Business School. Professor Hamel.
Well, thank you very much, Melinda, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club of California and the Harvard Business School Association of Northern California for creating a platform this evening for me to share a few ideas and thoughts with you. I think what I'd like to do this evening is really, since our time is short, to kind of just lay out five propositions, if I can. I'm going to call them propositions because that leaves plenty of room for debate and thinking and so on. But five propositions that I believe are really shaping the challenges of business and determining the kinds of responses that business is going to have in this very, very brave new world we're living in. Let me start by first of all saying that I believe that we've actually reached the end of progress. You know, before the kind of Renaissance, there was no progress. There were only cycles. Seasons came and went, and generations came and went, and things just were, and your children and grandchildren would live just like you did. But over the last 300 or 400 years, we believed that progress was not only possible, it was inevitable. And we expected lifespans to lengthen and material comforts to grow and knowledge to accumulate, and all that has happened. But it seems to me that now we really are at an inflection point in history where change has changed. It is no longer continuous. It is no longer to be kind of plotted and mapped and forecast. It is discontinuous. It is seditious. It is unexpected and often surprising. And in a sense, that has made a lot of people anxious. It's interesting that today, at least in the United States, we have kind of a record level of employment, extremely low unemployment. And despite that fact, you find more anxiety, more disenchantment in large organizations than probably ever, at least since we've started measuring these things. And I think the reason is that people understand in this new age, they and their organizations can be rendered irrelevant almost overnight. Last year, 1999, despite our close to full employment, we had a record number of layoffs in large American companies. We don't call this downsizing anymore. That was a 90s phenomenon. Now we call it churn, where we simply get rid of the people who are out of date, haven't kept up, and we bring on the bright young things who understand something about the future. Well, yes, it's an anxious time, but I think it's a time to be enormously hopeful. If you think about it, for all of human history, human beings have shared a set of dreams, as far back as you can go. We've dreamed forever about the ability to escape the geographic bonds that have tied us to one place. And today we can do that physically and virtually. We've dreamed through the millennia of the ability to access any bit of knowledge, wherever it was on the planet. That was the idea behind the library at Alexandria. Today we can do that. We've dreamed about the ability to reverse or at least slow down the ravages of disease, and looking to a world where we can grow organs in factories and manipulate the human genome, that seems a real possibility. So in a way, never before in history has the gap between what we can imagine and what we can accomplish been less. And all those dreams are now coming true, or to put it another way, for the first time in history, our heritage is no longer our destiny. And that gives us the right to dream new dreams. Yet for every Charles Babbage or Louis Pasteur or Gordon Moore or Jeff Bezos, There are tens of thousands of people and organizations whose minds are stuck in the greased grooves of history, whose imaginations cannot stretch to the new possibilities of the new age. Indeed, I find it rather ironic that the 20th century ended much the same way it began, at least as far as business and enterprise is concerned. The 20th century began with Frederick Winslow Taylor, the father of scientific management, in the factories with his stopwatch, following a very simple set of principles. Let me look at your processes, let me decompose them, find the things that don't add value, excise those, put your processes back together in more efficient ways. That was scientific management in the 1890s. Today we call it restructuring, re-engineering, ERP, supply chain integration, and any one of 100 other things that are really focused on getting faster, cheaper, and better. But I believe all the virtues of the industrial age, and virtues they were because they brought us unbelievable prosperity, all those virtues are now going to have to be complemented by new virtues. Certainly scale, efficiency, diligence, control, hierarchy, alignment, all of those things are important. But now we live in a world where we have to think about experimentation, imagination, putting together highly complex networks of individuals from around the world. And so it's no more simply, we're in this business forever, and how do we get better? Now we have to think about how we get different and different and different again. And so on one hand, you have the models of the old economy, as it's sometimes called, DuPont and AT&T and General Motors and their ilk. All of these companies born 75 to 100 years ago, all of them acts of enormous human imagination as we moved away from craft-based industries. And today we celebrate companies like ICG, CMGI, SoftBank, Idealab, and a host of others. But I believe that these companies don't represent the new paradigm any more than those industrial behemoths represent the new paradigm. Because all of these will-of-the-wisp dot-coms and startups are going to have to encompass all of the virtues of the industrial age. And everyone is struggling right now to understand how do you deliver flawless customer service, how do you scale up, how do you run big infrastructure. And Amazon, for their part, is becoming a bricks-and-mortar company just as fast as they possibly can. So I would like to argue within a very few years, and probably less than that, there is going to be no talk of old economy and new economy. It's quite a nonsensical dichotomy. And every company is going to have to master all these virtues. And we are all together today facing the challenge of how do we invent the post-industrial enterprise. And it is going to be a synthesis of the virtues of old and new. In the age of revolution, as I like to call it, I think the kind of capital that is going to be most valuable for every organization is not structural capital, it's not the facilities, it's not the networks, it's not the plans. Neither, perhaps surprisingly, is it intellectual capital. It is not the competencies, the capabilities, the brands, the knowledge, but increasingly it's imagination capital, the ability to conceive of entirely new possibilities, as well as entrepreneurial capital. The ability to act on those things, to have a company that's filled with alchemists who can literally create something out of nothing. So that's my first proposition. The second proposition is this. In this age of revolution, incumbency has never been worth less. And I think instinctively we know that. As you look at any industry or any part of the world, you see dozens of hungry newcomers, companies that are burdened by no conventions, have no worship for the past, no precedent, nothing to protect, and they're turning industries upside down. Who would have guessed, for example, that a small Swedish organization, OM Group, that has been behind the automation of the Swedish Stock Exchange, would get in the middle of the proposed merger between the London Stock Exchange and the Frankfurt Stock Exchange? And they convinced at least a number of investors there that the future was not putting two dinosaurs together, but maybe there was an entirely new way to organize a stock exchange. And you see this around the world. In fact, I would argue we have a new industrial order. A few years ago, we thought about the competitive battle lines as between regions. It was the U.S. versus Japan versus the newly industrializing countries in Europe. And now I think that dividing line runs right through the middle of every economy. And it separates the insurgents from the incumbents, the vanguard from the old guard. And the only question for any organization is on which side of that divide does your organization sit? And you should take no comfort if your company is young. Because I think in this world we live in, any company that's more than one day old is already an incumbent. You know, the wet cement of orthodoxy and dogma has already begun to set. That's why, as much as anything else, Silicon Valley is a graveyard for companies who only ever had one strategy and could never reinvent themselves, even though some of them managed to reinvent their industries. I think, though, the reason that incumbency is worth less is we live in a world where there are so many things that are changing truly in a nonlinear way. If you plot over the last few years the growth of bandwidth, the growth of what we know about the human genome, the pace of deregulation around the world, the penetration of wireless technology, not to mention the internet. Almost anything you look at today, you plot its change, it's changing at an exponential rate. Things you might not have even expected. For example, the amount of money that parents spend on their children between the ages of 4 and 12 years old has doubled every decade since the 60s and it tripled in the 90s. We have the most sophisticated generation of children that has ever existed on this planet. I talked a while ago to a woman who runs part of the Barbie business for Mattel, and I asked her how her business had changed. And she said, a few years ago, the core market for Barbie was girls between the ages of 6 and 12 years old. Today, our core market is girls from 3 to 6. And you think about the implications of a world in which there are no more little girls, there are only small women. There are all kinds of industries that are not alert to this. I ask my friends in the banking business, why don't you have debit cards for kids instead of paying them allowance? Give them a debit card, transfer so much every month from my account to theirs. There's a limit on how much they can charge, and I'm never going to forget again to give them their allowance. Well, you know, every decade for the last several decades, somebody has come along and written a book celebrating corporate longevity. In Search of Excellence, Built to Last, The Living Companies. But I wonder, with a bit of hindsight, if these books really weren't celebrations of momentum in a slow-spinning world. Because I'm not so sure that in this new kind of world, the incumbency counts for anything at all. Think about this. In 1995, there were about 25 million mobile phones sold in the world. Last year, 1999, there were 275 million mobile phones. This year, probably more than 400 million. That is an exponential curve. And somewhere in there, Motorola missed a critical change just by a few months, the shift from analog to digital. And in that sliver of time, they lost their leadership to a funny little company perched up on the edge of the Arctic Circle, Nokia. Today you blink and the game is over. The same thing has happened with the internet portal business. If I'm Sony, if I'm Bertelsmann, if I'm some big company that missed this, my only choice is to go, you know, sign a check for $10 billion for a company that still is hemorrhaging cash, and somehow try to climb onto the caboose of this train that has just passed me by. Third proposition. Given all of this, e-commerce is not enough. It is certainly not the answer to the challenges companies face today. You know, after a bout of euphoria over the last few years, we're now confronted by hundreds of e-failures. And the list of the dead and the wounded, I won't even begin to read. But it is a very, very long list. And no wonder. Essentially what happened again and again was VCs cooked up some kind of an e-business souffle. Let me give you the recipe. You start with a heaping bowl of VC funding. You add the merest hint of a business model. You fold in ignorant investors, pour out a teaspoonful of shares, whip up some word of mouth, frost with euphoria, and carefully remove from the IPO oven. Well, that's fine. But that's not creating businesses that last or even businesses that will reward shareholders particularly. I came across a couple of quotes just literally in the last day or so that illustrated this. The first is from Mike Jewell, who is a co-founder of BirthdayExpress.com. They've had their own challenges there, and this is what he said. The dot-com collapse has forced us to build a business model instead of an internet story. Or George Shaheen, the chairman of WebVan and previous CEO of Anderson Consulting, in this market, a flawed business model will just disintegrate. Well, guess what, George? A flawed business model disintegrates in just about any market, but certainly it will disintegrate in this one. So I don't think that the real challenge is really not the old guard versus all these new e-companies. I think the challenges and the battle lines are going to be companies that continue reinventing themselves and companies that don't. Let me give you one little example. For the last 5 years, Fortune magazine has rated Enron as the most innovative company in America. More than Cisco, more than Intel, more than Microsoft, and any of the kind of high-tech darlings. Some of you may know that Enron is based in Houston, Texas, had its start as a gas pipeline company. from gas pipelines that set itself the goal of becoming the world's first gas major, natural gas major, like Shell would be a petroleum major. From there, it set itself to become the world's leading trader of energy of all kinds, gas, electricity, and coal, and so on. Today, it is making markets in things like bandwidth, and it sees a future now of making markets literally anywhere you've had customers and suppliers linked together by long-term contracts and markets that are not very liquid. Every 3 to 4 years, this company's core definition of who they are has changed. You know, it used to be that organizations changed about once a decade in the middle of a crisis when they traded out one top management team for another. That is an expensive way to change. Today, 40% of Enron's market value comes from businesses they weren't in 3 years ago. They haven't spun businesses out. They've made no great big mega mergers, but yet they're constantly reinventing themselves, and I think that's going to have to become the norm rather than the exception. I'd also like any large company to think about the investments they're making in E today. They are necessary. You can't avoid them, but I'd like them to think about two other kind of issues around E. One is that more than anything else, the Internet is going to destroy friction. And Internet boosters celebrate the fact that we're moving towards a world of frictionless capitalism, and as consumers, we also should celebrate. But the reality is many, many companies have owed most of their profits to friction of the following sort. Banks, customer ignorance was a huge profit center. There's hardly a person that can tell you for sure they're getting right now the best rate on their mortgage, the best rate on their checking account, the best deal on their credit cards. You don't know. In fact, I almost think that over every bank in the granite, there should have been an engraving that says, "Stupidity, welcome here." They made money out of the fact that it was difficult for you to compare. No longer. Neutrality rules. You can go online, find the information, have immediate comparison. There are no more ignorant customers. Many companies had local monopolies, the jewelers, the universities, the radio stations, right? If I lived here in San Francisco or nearby, I had to listen to the radio stations here. Now I can sit at home, broadcast.com, I listen to the BBC live from London. There are no more local monopolies. There are no more weak customers. Aggregation and the whole B2B thing means that every customer, every company out there has the potential buying power of a Walmart. So the hard truth for many companies, I believe, is that the price-deflating impact of the web, as it slowly weeds out all this friction, is going to substantially overwhelm the efficiency-enhancing impacts of the web. And if you want to look at a little data here, it's interesting that for the last 5 years, the average operating margin of the S&P 500 companies has hardly changed a whit, despite billions of dollars of investment in information technology. Investments that have brought enormous efficiencies. Recently, a friend of mine, the chief economist at Goldman Sachs, went back and looked at what happened when America electrified the original E. And he found that what happened then was exactly what I predicted would happen now in a recent article I wrote for the Wall Street Journal, that all those years ago, all the efficiency gains of electrification went to one of two places, into consumers' pockets or into the market value of the arms suppliers, the companies making all that gear. Today, all of the efficiency, and I mean all of the efficiency gains of the web, are likely to end up in the pockets of consumers or in the market cap of Cisco, Oracle, and the rest of those arms suppliers, which is fine. I half in jest recently talking to a large industry group, many competitors sitting together, I in jest suggested that maybe the greatest service I could do them would be to negotiate technology non-proliferation agreements industry-wide. So, you know, we all stop the arms race. Well, it's unlikely to happen, but don't look to your investments in E to make the critical difference in your competitiveness. They won't. Two last short propositions. Those who live by the sword will be shot by those who don't. And I think you can see what I mean there clearly enough. We are in a world where incrementalism simply doesn't cut it anymore. Yet if you look at what so many large companies have been doing over the last decade, one, they've been in there with all their efficiency programs. We are coming to the end of that. And empirically, you can demonstrate that in most companies, we're reaching diminishing returns on efficiency programs. Number two, there's been a wave of mega mergers. And this is what you do when you've exhausted internal efficiency programs and you slam two big organizations together, take out another few thousand jobs and a big tranche of overhead. It's been interesting to watch some of these. I was writing a piece for the Financial Times a while back on one of these big mega mergers, and they cut my first sentence. It's a conservative newspaper. I had said about one of these mega mergers, this may be the only place outside of Jurassic Park you can watch dinosaurs mate. And they thought I had gone just a tad too far there, and perhaps I did. But most of the things that companies use to drive wealth creation over the last decade simply are not going to work. At the current rate of mergers in the United States, we'd have one company 7 years from now. I don't think it's going to happen. So instead, I think the real challenge today is business concept innovation. Not innovation in products and technology. Indeed, there is no correlation today between a company's patent performance and its wealth creation performance. The real challenge today is not innovating in technology or products alone, but really inventing entirely new ways of putting industries together. And I'll give you some simple examples quickly. A French company, Sephora, in cosmetics, has not much to do with E as I can tell, but they had a totally new way of selling cosmetics. Instead of walking into a department store and seeing a counter for Lancome, Chanel, Estee Lauder, with their own employees behind the counter, everything under glass, hoping really they have the chance to make your whole face, you go into Sephora and there's every perfume in the world on a wall from A to Z, every lipstick lined up by color, nothing under glass, no one on commission. That is an entirely new business concept. And you can demonstrate that most of the new wealth in our economy over the last 10 years has been created by companies with radical new business concepts. So a lot of companies know how to innovate around technology, marketing. Very few have learned to produce a string of radical new business concepts. I was in New York a few weeks ago. On the back of the bus was a big sign. It said, who's the father? And I took pause. I thought that perhaps New Yorkers are uncertain generally about paternity. I couldn't tell. But I thought I'd at least go check this out. So I went to the website of a company called Identigene.com. And for a small amount of money, you can send two bits of human matter to them, and they will tell you whether two people are genetically related. That is a new business concept. How many of us guessed in year 2000 you'd have online consumer genetic matching as a business proposition? Those things are possible today. Last proposition. I think every organization, large and small, is going to have to bring Silicon Valley inside. The reality is that most companies look a whole lot more like the Soviet Union inside than they look like Silicon Valley. You know, most companies are still governed by a system of resource allocation. An idea has to fight its way up through uncomprehending levels of management. Finally, somebody at the top says, gee, all right, we'll do this. That's if the person hasn't gotten fed up and left. And of course, you know, there's no giant brain in Silicon Valley. There's no giant CEO sitting there making big allocation decisions. Somebody with an idea has dozens of VCs to go to. There's dozens of choices in how you fund it and get capital. Indeed, Silicon Valley works not on resource allocation, but resource attraction. Either an idea attracts talent and capital, or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, it dies a fairly natural death. I would argue that Silicon Valley is, in essence, three markets that will have to be replicated inside of every company if they hope to compete in the future. The first is the market for ideas. The average venture capitalist gets about 5,000 unsolicited business plans in a year. The average divisional vice president gets three or two or none, but not many. The second market is a market not for ideas, but for experimental capital. It's extremely easy to raise your first $400,000 or $500,000 from angels and get a start. Yet inside most companies, we have a capital budgeting process that was built on the assumption that you should never make a mistake. And so the assumption is, don't bring something to me that doesn't have at least 90% chance of success. Of course, a VC knows that on average, you know, maybe only half of your portfolio is going to be a huge success. Maybe on average, the things you invested have a 30 or 40% chance of being huge winners. And in most companies, the last thing you could do is go to somebody and say, we have this really terrific idea, but, you know, honestly, we probably have no better than 30, 40% chance of success. The other challenge you have in large companies is when you want capital, you typically have to go to people defending the old model to get it. Imagine if everybody in Silicon Valley had to get their funding from Bill Gates, and you'll get the picture, right? Pretty soon from San Jose to the Golden Gate, everybody here would be working on extending the Windows franchise, perish the thought. The last market that exists in Silicon Valley is a market for talent. talent quickly migrates to the best opportunities. A company that's going sideways is going to lose its talent real fast. Yet in so many large companies, divisional vice presidents, the people running yesterday's legacy businesses, believe that somehow they own the talent. Well, I think it's possible to bring Silicon Valley inside. I think it's possible to create vibrant internal markets for ideas, for capital and talent. But in doing so, we are going to challenge many of the very premises on which industrial age companies were built. We're going to challenge the premise that change starts from the top. We're going to challenge the premise that experience counts for more for imagination. We're going to challenge the premise that what really counts is the ability to make big bets instead of the ability to start a lot of small things. Let me leave you with a metaphor, if I can. You know, I think the challenge in any organization today is not to make the next big billion-dollar investment, but it's to be running dozens and maybe hundreds of small new rules experiments everywhere all the time. Not with huge amounts of funding, but where you can experiment, learn, and adapt at a very rapid pace. If you think about it, the way the Valley works, and I think the way innovation works generally, is you probably need 1,000 ideas to be bubbling around. Out of those 1,000 ideas, maybe you start 100 small experiments. Out of those 100 experiments, maybe 10 are worth actually taking to the next stage and putting some real capital behind. And out of those 10, maybe there are a couple that turn into, you know, enormously exciting new propositions. Well, in most organizations, when I go and I talk to their senior executives and I say, tell me, where are those 1,000 new unconventional strategic options that you guys have been generating? And where do I go to see the range of possibilities that you've created here out of this enormous intellectual capital you have? They have nothing to point to. When I ask them, you know, where are the 100 new rule experiments going on across your big organization? Very little to point to. And the analogy is this, and forgive me for it in advance. I recently asked one of my brothers, who is a physician, I asked him, when a man and a woman are working together to make a baby, how many sperm tend to get wasted in the process? And the answer was, on average, 59,999,999. But having been a parent and a father, I know that we don't bemoan the little guys who didn't make it, right? We celebrate the success. And yet, I think if I can be this blunt, the challenge for a lot of companies is they have a very low corporate sperm count, right? They have just not started enough new things. And I made this analogy recently. I was talking to the board of a British company, and a very lovely old British gentleman there, one of the board members, he cleared his throat and he says, Gary, now really? You know, I think you could have said that it takes a lot of acorns to make an oak tree. And I said, indeed it does, but you're going to remember corporate sperm count long after you forgot the oak tree. So I think that's the challenge. And the interesting thing for me is many of the companies that are the product of Silicon Valley have never learned to internalize the lessons of Silicon Valley. So I think we have a unique opportunity right now in history. And I think the opportunity is this. We have the chance, all of us together, in whatever organizations we work, we have the chance to begin to invent the post-industrial enterprise. It hasn't been invented yet. I don't think there's any, you know, excellent company. There's no paragon that you can point to as having figured this out. But I think it's an amazing challenge. We are lucky beyond belief to have this chance right now. And I wish you good luck and Godspeed as you wrestle with these issues in your own organizations. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Hamill, for your remarks on the new industrial order. I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who are thinking quite differently about how their businesses work right now. I would like to now introduce Ken Hausman, who will conduct the question and answer session. Ken is the co-founder and managing director of Mentor Venture Partners and Osprey Ventures, early stage venture investment partnerships. He has been active in the software and information processing industry since the early 1980s. Ken also sits on the NASDAQ's President's Advisor Board and is currently on leave from the Commonwealth Club Board of Advisors. Ken?
Okay. Why don't we start with the first question that the audience has so kindly proffered is, throughout Silicon Valley, companies are led by younger and younger management teams. Is techno-savviness becoming more important than management experience in the new era?
Well, I think one of the reasons they're being led by younger and younger managers is that the pace of company, as the pace of company formation accelerates, that's all that's left.
Right? I mean, we've got to find, you know, and as you guys, I don't have to tell you, there's a huge shortage of executive and management talent. And I think a lot of the times, the reason they're led by younger and younger people is not, that's not, you know, what we would like. That's not necessarily the best, but that's who we can find. I think experienced operating managers are the scarcest commodity right now in Silicon Valley. And I think people who can find people with that experience, but both who still have the energy and the passion to be entrepreneurs, those are lucky people indeed. I would say, however, that I think that, young people do in general live closer to the future than some of us guys who are getting more gray hair. And I think that's just a fact. I don't think it has to be that way. But I think it's a challenge for all of us as we age to maintain the energy, the curiosity, the enthusiasm for learning new things. And I think that's why, you know, some people do feel nervous in this new economy. But young CEOs, I think, may be as much a product of a scarcity of executive talent as it is for some preference necessarily for simply, people who are still on their third razor.
Kind of a follow-on here, we have people thinking along the same lines. What is to stop the rebels of today from becoming the status quo of tomorrow?
No, I think that's a really good question, and I think that's indeed what's happening. I mean, let me just give you one notable example. I think that a few years ago, we all would have said that SAP, the German company, was one of the new insurgents. Suddenly, they miss what's going on with the Internet a bit. They don't reward their U.S. management team as lavishly as they should have. About 150 of those people depart. And in the space of about 18 to 24 months, SAP moves from the insurgent side of the ledger to the incumbent side of the ledger. So I think that's, you know, I think there's, particularly in young companies, there's an enormous amount of hubris. You know, we're the people who are going to go disrupt everything. You know, we're going to show the old guard, how stupid they are. But you don't have to have much historical perspective to know that you are just as vulnerable as the firms that you displaced. And so I think the challenge is not to be a revolutionary once, but to be a revolutionary again and again and again. And that's difficult for the following simple reason. The first time you create an industry revolution, you have to challenge the orthodoxies of the incumbents. To do it twice, you have to challenge your own. And I think we would all know which of those is harder.
Okay. How can Silicon Valley businesses prepare not to fold under the dot-com collapse?
Yeah, well, I think that's a lot more challenging question. First of all, probably 90% of them deserve to fold. Last year, and you all will have all seen this data, and it depends on whose data you look at, but for example, last year, about $9 billion of venture capital went into more than 600 B2B companies. Well, how many of those do you think are going to be, you know, strong, vital organizations 10 years from now? 2%, 4%, some kind of, that's probably would be my guess, 5%. So I think what has happened, and you can look at the curves, if you look at the venture capital funding curve, just for here in the Bay Area, over the last 5 or 6 years, it literally just goes straight skyward. It is one of those, you know, exponential curves. And then you add to that all the corporate venture financing that is now pouring in, as every corporation, you know, wants to buy a piece of this action. And I think you almost have to conclude that the funding has outrun the pace of really wonderful new ideas. And, how possibly can you imagine 600 companies, many of them with almost identical strategies? It's kind of, you know, 100 rats in a very small cage and a little bit of food. Well, not many of those rats are going to survive. That's the way it is. And I think that, one of the things I believe that's happened is this. Every venture capitalists and everyone in Silicon Valley and beyond hopes to discover one of these wonderful increasing returns business models, right? They all would love to find the next eBay or the next Mirabilis, right, that invented ICQ becomes AOL Instant Messenger or the next Hotmail, right? And so, you know, how many people are out there talking about viral marketing and all these wonderful things? Well, the reality is once everybody understands that the game is to find an increasing returns business model, and everybody knows that the game, if you ever want to win one of those, you got to get to the goalpost first. then what happens? Everybody enormously escalates their spending on advertising. We got to be the first to build a big, you know, national brand. Everyone gives away masses of products to customers. We got to build our installed base. And so pretty soon, everyone is spending at this ferocious pace. And in a way, you find that there is no more undervalued market share. You can no longer buy an increasing returns business model at a discount because everybody's heading for the same place. And so I think that you know, one of the kind of myths I think in Silicon Valley is ideas are cheap and it's all about execution. Well, that's partly true. But I would argue truly rule-breaking, industry-changing ideas are actually very rare. And 95% of startups don't have one. And so they and a whole bunch of others are all pouring in capital, hoping to get to that goal line first. And maybe, you know, if you have something that's truly unique and you don't have 600 other companies heading in the same direction, you can still get there first. But the real, I think, unique currency is a business concept that's different, that's doable, and where you have some kind of a foresight lead time.
You've highlighted that Silicon Valley seems to be a very productive environment. What are the greatest risks it faces? What would you do if you were the king of Silicon Valley?
Well, thank goodness there'll never be a king here, because if I was king, I'd probably only screw it up. But it's a place that is mightily resistant, I think, to that kind of central direction. But I think the central risk, is hubris. I've lived here for a good number of years, and you travel anywhere in the world and you tell people you're from Silicon Valley and they immediately think, you know, the air is different here and you can walk on water and you know, there's some magical property to all of this, and clearly there's not. We've been through boom and bust cycles in this part of California before, and by God, we're going to go through them again. I think that you just look at some of the underlying trends. You look at the capacity of organizations to absorb greater spending on information technology. There's a limit to that. You look at this ratio of, you know, amount of capital to amount of ideas. You look at that. There's a lot of things that would say, I can put it like this, that the rose is sweetest just before the petals fall off. So I think that is the greatest danger. And I think you've seen that over the last couple of years, this sense that somehow just sheer hubris and cash and so on can substitute for really creative thinking and really deep experience. And, you know, that's proving not to be the case.
You seem to be making progress here, because the next question asks if you were president of the United States. What policies would you be advocating, seeking to implement? And what government structures would you be seeking to implement? I think that gets at the issue of, you know, localization of government versus national and the like.
Well, you know, I probably pretty much have to declare my hand there. I believe in less government rather than more, and I believe in whatever government there is should be subject wherever possible to market disciplines. I think there's a reason that you've seen over the last few years Americans largely turn off to politics. I mean, it's a complex issue, but I'll tell you at least one or two reasons that I personally believe. Most people who work in private sector organizations have seen their organizations turned upside down over the last few years as they try to get efficient and lean and embrace new technology and reinvent themselves from the customer backwards and all of those wonderful things. We've all been through it, those of us who work in organizations. We've been through the challenges, the 12-hour days, you know, the fresh thinking, the throwing out all of the old beliefs. And yet when you look at government, you see very little of that same, you know, a deep challenging and reinventing and so on. And it's kind of hard, you know, to look at government as credible when they don't seem to be subjecting themselves to the same kind of deep searching. And again, I'm sorry, this will be political. It's not meant to be so. But when Al Gore was heading up the Reinventing Government program, if all of the things that they had suggested, all of the policies they had suggested would have been implemented, the savings would have amounted to 1% of the federal budget. Well, I don't know a CEO in the world who would stand up and say, we just had this huge task force and turned over every stone and every orthodoxy. We're going to implement this all. We're going to save 1%. And so, you know, I just think that there's a huge disconnect between the creativity and the challenges that the private sector have taken upon themselves and what you see, at least federally, in the public sector. I think locally you see enormous amount of innovation, but I'm afraid not as much as we'd like federally.
Okay. The next question you may wish to decline to answer, but we're going to ask it anyway. Which presidential candidate, in your opinion, is best equipped to deal with the age of revolution over the next 4 to 8 years?
I guess I'd like to say none of the above is probably the safest way to say that. I think that, and in some sense, maybe that's a good thing. Because my view is we are getting ready for the future pretty damn well in this country. There have been a few bobbles. I think our government screwed up in a substantial way around the wireless kind of revolution and what happened there. But I think in general, I don't ask the government to do much but to let us get on with things. Clearly, there are important issues. There's issues around antitrust. I think if I was an entrepreneur today, I would certainly want a vigorous enforcement of antitrust. As we see, the dinosaurs, as I said earlier. Secondly, clearly I want government to protect intellectual property. You cannot simply rip people's hard work off. It doesn't mean that the music industry and others are not going to have to adapt, but we have to have a regime where we do respect, I think, other people's intellectual property. But you know, beyond those basic challenges, I think we'll figure it out just fine.
Okay, very good. Do you believe the United States has a competitive advantage in the way that capital, information, and people move so freely compared to other countries, other areas around the world?
Yeah, I think it is very clear. I think the Europeans are struggling with this. I sat a few weeks ago with Gordon Brown, the Chancellor of the Exchequer for the UK, and they are wrestling with issues that largely we have, I think, already successfully wrestled with. Issues like how do you reduce social costs? How do you make it easier for people to change jobs? How do you liberalize your telecoms sector so the costs of internet access are not prohibitive? And most of Europe is still struggling with these issues. So I think we are definitely ahead on that game. On the other hand, most of the things that is holding Europe back, all of the things I think that are holding Europe and Japan back, have mostly to do with social policy and regulation. They have very little to do or nothing to do with the inherent creativity and imagination of the people. Europe is producing an amazing array of new companies at the moment, but I think there are still many, many things in European public policy that implicitly protect the incumbents. And many European governments for very many years have seen their goal as making sure their big national champions win around the world rather than creating an environment in which the newcomers have a reasonable shot at displacing those champions. And, of course, you protect the big champions. They get slow. They get lazy. And that's why you see, telecoms cost structures in banking, a lot of these things, so much higher there than they are here.
We seem to have a theme going here. Traveling around the world, can you see any, or can you identify any potential geographic area where there's going to be a boom like Silicon Valley? Where would that be, and why would that be?
I think that in general, you're going to see Silicon Valley-like things happening everywhere on the planet over the next 10 or 15 years. Because what is happening is we are all converging. Well, first of all, the example of the U.S. is so compelling that nobody in the world can ignore it. And so wherever I go, I was a few months ago talking to the Prime Minister in Singapore and the Cabinet in Singapore, and that company is single-mindedly focused on becoming the most innovative country in Asia. They are here. They're learning from us. They're adapting it. They're improving upon it. You see the same thing happening in Brazil. So I don't think we're going to have any monopoly on innovation and creativity. A lot of companies around the world took lessons from our large companies as they went through the downsizing, the efficiency. You find that now happening around the world. They're also taking lessons from how we've organized for innovation. So, there are going to be probably some black spots here and there. But I think in general, we have seen over the last decade an enormous amount of macroeconomic convergence. And I think we are going to see over the next decade a lot of convergence in the kind of political structures and organizational structures that allow innovation to flourish, because the alternative is you simply get left behind and you can't enjoy the kind of accelerating standard of living that we've seen in this country for the last now, 10 years, the longest bull market in history.
Sounds somewhat Darwinian in a way. Let's talk about education a little bit. Is there a particular approach to education, other than going to Harvard Business School, of course, for those who are here from Harvard Business School, that encourages innovative thinking?
A particular approach. Well, I said that in general, education works to diminish innovative thinking pretty much whenever I've come across it. Because all too many times, I mean, it's interesting, I was talking to a physicist recently, Alan Kay, who is the father of the personal computer when he was at Xerox PARC. And shortly thereafter, I had a chance to talk to Paul Krugman, a world-renowned economist. And what I asked them both was, how long in your discipline does it take for major paradigms to shift? And both of them said it takes about 25 years. And I said, well, why 25 years? Well, that's about the time it takes for one generation to die off and another generation to come up. Which is kind of a sad commentary, is that in, I think, a lot of universities, it's kind of an intellectual imperialism that makes it very difficult to challenge kind of the beliefs. And I've struggled that every place I've been a professor and taught young PhD students is, you know, the reality is those students have their best chance to invent new things, to challenge existing theories, 25, 30, 35 years old. But typically, we ensure that for the first 10 or 15 years of their career, they have to spend their time like elaborating in small, insignificant ways the theories of their great forebears. And by the time they get enough gray hair and enough tenure and enough refereed articles to say something different, they've been kind of totally co-opted. So I tell you where I have a lot of hope, though, for what education can do. And this is something I've said to the folks at Harvard Business School and other places as well. We have the chance over the next 2 years to make world-class education less elitist than it has ever been before. You know, when I talk to, and I'm friends obviously with a lot of the folks at Harvard, and when I talk to them, or I'd say the same thing to folks at Stanford or anywhere else, you know, why are you training 800 or 900 MBAs a year? Why aren't you reaching 1 million or 2 million or 10 million people a year? Today it is easy to do with technology. I can imagine a business school in which, first of all, there is no admission requirement, there's only an exit requirement. Because if the cost of serving an additional student is zero, why would I have any admission? The only reason we have an admission requirement now is you only have so many seats to fill. And so we make up these elaborate tests to weed people out. We know for a fact that how tall you are has just about as much impact on how high you rise in an organization as anything else. I'd be willing to throw out the graduate management admission test in favor of a ruler, but I don't think you'd probably get sued for doing that, I don't know. But only half in jest there. But I think there's a challenge today. Somebody's going to do this. What I'm amazed by is that nobody's done it yet. Somebody's going to say, I know business schools. You could do it in other schools, but I happen to know business schools best. Somebody's going to say, let me take the 30 best business school professors in the world. By the way, all of which earn 90% of their income outside of the business schools. Because a business school has a very strange economics. It's one guy in front of 60 students, right? So, I mean, how profitable can that be? But they're going to take the top 30 in the world. They're going to pay them like you would pay a basketball star. They're going to say, we'll let you reach hundreds of thousands and millions of people. And I have a sense that whoever does that first, you know, the great brands of Harvard and Wharton and so on will still stand. But if you say to a student, you can spend 2 years in Boston or 2 years in Philadelphia or London, or you can study with the 30 best business minds in the world, you know, I'm not sure that there's not some reasonable number of students who say, let me take the best business minds. And I think in a very short period of time, you could undermine the brands of even some of the most important educational institutions in the world. So, I mean, to me, that is probably the single most exciting and hopeful thing about this new age is that knowledge that was so incredibly sticky is about to get incredibly slippery. And, you know, we are going to level the knowledge playing field across this world as we've never done before. And I'm just waiting for somebody to call me and say, gee, Gary, let's go build the global cyber business school. And here's some capital to do it.
And we can talk about that after the program. If you had or have young children, what advice would you give them, and what kind of upbringing and education would you provide them in this changing environment that you've described?
Well, my children are now in kind of late teenage years, but I'll tell you what we try to do for better or for worse, and I think there are many ways to answer that question. Let me only choose one. But one of the things that we tried to do was to make them global citizens. And they, I think, by the time they were in their teens, they had lived outside of the United States for 10 years. They had been in about 50 countries around the world. And I think that today, the ability to move effortlessly from one culture to another, one country to another, the ability to borrow ideas from wherever they come in the world, the sense of being at home as a global citizen, I think is just an enormous advantage. So I think that that is one thing. I think more generally, the advice I would give them now as they're a little older, which is, I guess, hard won for me over a period of years, but I think it's made a difference in my life, is maybe three pieces of advice, three or four pieces of advice. One, work on a big problem. You may not be able to solve it. You'll never solve it all by yourself, but be able to say, I am working on something that is important. And I think a lot of us end up, you know, in our world of specialization and so on, we forget the bigger thing we're working on. And, you know, so you're not going to make a big difference unless you start with a big problem. And that's number one. For me, number two is to be a contrarian, to never accept conventional wisdom, to always turn things upside down, to always ask the question of why, to be constantly alert to the small absurdities that are all around you that everybody else seems to take for granted. I mean, it's like this can be actually a curse. You know, I walk into a hotel room and I wonder if everybody else in the world washes their hair in the sink because the shampoo is always by the sink, right? I mean, to me, that's just absurd. Why isn't it in the shower? Well, anyway. But I think to be able to look at things and turn them around, I think, is terribly important. I think number three is whatever you do, you have to do it in service of a cause that you believe is both right and righteous. And you have to start out. You can't make a difference unless you truly have, I think, an enormous amount of empathy for the struggles and the issues that people are facing. And so if you look at things in simply a technical way, a puzzle-solving way, I think you lose your humanity and you lose the chance to make a substantial difference. And I think the last thing is be very careful and very creative with the language. You know, if you want to influence people and change them, you have to be able to use language that is evocative, that gives them a simple handle with which they can pick up a big and complicated idea. And I think, I hope that as they now grow up and mature and seek to make their own kind of difference in the world, those are some of the lessons they would keep in mind.
In the new world, what happens to brands? What's the importance of the brand?
I think brands are always going to be important, but I think you have to look at them in the right kind of way. I've watched with kind of interest as the car companies have all gotten very serious about branding. And it worried me. I mean, I knew that probably they weren't going to succeed at this when they went and hired a lot of their brand people from places like Procter & Gamble. You know, very few of us have ever fallen in love with a box of Tide detergent, you know, or Crest toothpaste. And you look at, if I can stick with the car industry just as an example here, you look at the brands that actually really mean something like BMW or Corvette or whatever it may be. These are brands that are simply buckets into which a whole host of product attributes have been consistently poured, attributes that are exciting and emotionally compelling and so on. And I think there are some companies that believe that somehow if you just get the right slogan and the right advertising, you can just kind of like sprinkle this brand fairy dust on mediocre products and, you know, turn a Lumina into a, you know, a 325 or something. And so I think brands are going to be important, but I think brand is simply the summation of all the wonderful and cool and unique things you've done for customers. And, you know, you can't kind of manufacture, often you can't manufacture these things out of thin air. You can in some cases where the product attributes themselves are very hard to distinguish. Absolute Vodka might be an example of that. I mean, it's interesting, just to take one example, I mentioned Nokia earlier. I just saw a latest survey from Interbrand, which kind of tracks the global value of brands. And Nokia is now about number six or number seven in terms of global brands. And you think about how does a company that none of you could have pronounced their name 5 years ago is now number six or seven in the world. And I think it comes from a string of truly awesome products. And a string of compelling messages to the next generation of consumers and so on. So brands are important, but you know, I think customers are so sophisticated today that it's getting harder and harder to build them by hype, it's harder and harder to build them just by, you know, sheer repetition and getting in front of people. I one of the things I find very interesting about the internet and how that's going to change branding is when we were all watching television most of the time, the big advertisers could literally take our attention hostage. They'd say, pardon us, but for the next 30 or 60 seconds, we own your television screen. And, you know, we'll hand it back to you when we're done extolling the virtues of Ultrabright or, you know, whatever it may have been. You know, so we sat through the toothy lovers and, you know, kissing, and we sat through, you know, the people dancing and shouting the merits of some brown fizzy soft drink and so on. But I thought to myself, what would happen if somebody, while I've been surfing, somebody says, just a moment, we're going to take your computer hostage for the next 60 seconds and tell you about coffee. Right, I mean, I would just go ballistic. Many of you know there are a whole variety of applications or little applets, whatever you call them. One is called Ad Wiper, and I guess another one's called Ad Guard. But for about $20, you can put a little thing on your computer that will wipe out every single banner, every single ad before you download the page, and better yet, when you're done, it will give you a body count, how many ads you killed during your session. And, you know, it's a pretty cool world for when $20 you can destroy the primary economic model of the internet. I mean, you know, that's a trip.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of personal relationships and networking in a world where zeros and ones are flying around faster and faster and globalization is occurring?
Yeah, maybe two thoughts on that. And maybe in this sense, both I think the good and the not so good side of the internet. If you look at global GDP or GDP per capita over the last 1,000 years, you find that for the first 850 years, it's flat. And the last 150 years, it shoots straight north. It just zooms up. And in that sense, you know, we live in this tiny, tiny sliver of human history and are just blessed beyond any kind of measure. But you ask yourself, why now? And it's a complicated answer, but I think the essence of it is this. Over the last 150 years, we've had better and better ways of connecting people and their ideas. From the steamship to the telegraph to the telephone to the automobile, you know, and now the internet and in between the airplane. And economic growth is finally driven by the number and the quality of connections between people and their ideas. That's why I don't think that anytime soon we're going to kind of come to some plateau here. It doesn't mean that in 5 or 10 year cycles we're not going to have huge economic disruptions. But if I look at over the next 100 years, I think basically it's an upward trajectory. You know, God save us from nuclear war, from some other catastrophe like that. So in that sense, I think the internet is this powerful device for bringing people together, for allowing them to share, and as the media there becomes richer and richer, I expect that to accelerate. On the other hand, I think it is going to be sad if the internet isolates us, connects us to the world, but isolates us from our neighbors. That, I would think, would be a loss. You know, there's a lot of talk about online communities, and I don't want to get into an argument with people who have found a lot of support and succor from online help groups and communities. But I would say that still today, for the most part, on the net, we are voyeurs. And when we get bored, we just leap. And the responsibilities that we have to neighbors to watch their children when they're sick or help them when their house burns down or run an errand for them when they can't are by and large responsibilities that we have not yet figured out or even want to execute on the web. So I think it's still a little misnomer to talk about online communities. Yes, they're of a sort, but I think that I think we'll all lose as human beings if we don't continue to have a sense of responsibility to those who are most immediately around us as well as those who we can interact with at our leisure somewhere else on the globe.
Unfortunately, we have reached that time in the program where we have time for just one last question, and it's going to be a two-parter. What companies, I'm going to give them both to you now, and we'll revisit them if you forget one, but what companies have a high corporate sperm count? And then can you describe a consulting experience that made your jaw drop?
That made my jaw drop? Yeah, I'll try to do both of those things quickly. Let me come back to a company I mentioned earlier, just because we've already built a little understanding so I can give a shorter answer, and that's Enron. Jeff Skilling, who's their president, and who I know rather well, I sit on the chairman's advisory board there, he said this recently. He said, if you put a circle around Silicon Valley, I would hope that it looks like Enron, not the other way around. If you put a circle around Silicon Valley, I hope it would look like Enron. And he went on to say this. Of course, innovation is easier within Enron than it is in Silicon Valley because there is less friction here. You don't have to change employers. You don't have to go through the same hurdles to get investment. And I thought about that, and I thought, how many company presidents would say, of course it's easier to innovate in my company. You know, I can't imagine, you know, Mr. Armstrong at AT&T with a straight face saying that, or any other of 100 CEOs. And I think of any company I know, Enron has come closest to cracking the code. And I think just a couple of little things that I think have made it kind of work there. One is they have found a way to reward the people who help Enron create new wealth spectacularly without spinning out the businesses they help create. In so many companies right now with incubators and venture funds, we're essentially creating innovation ghettos because we have no other way of really rewarding people except creating new capital structures and spinning the things out, which exacerbates brain drain. It means you're not really leveraging all the competencies and assets you have. And I think Enron has begun to solve that in some way. And I'll tell you just a little anecdote that illustrates this. A young woman named Louise Kitchen, 29 years old, was working for Enron in their London trading floor, trading natural gas for Enron in Europe. She believed that Enron was not kind of getting the internet thing quite as fast as it should. Indeed, up until, this is about a year and a half ago, any attempt to create any kind of online energy market had just been an abysmal failure because it is so complex to trade, so many jurisdictional issues. And indeed, it was probably impossible for anybody to do this without a principle-based system. In other words, without somebody guaranteeing liquidity in the market and putting their capital and their supply at risk in the trade. So top management at Enron thought this was probably never going to happen. They certainly didn't have an idea of how Enron could do this. And so Louise started a one-person campaign. She didn't ask anybody for permission. There was no corporate emergency internet task force, right? But she started lobbying people, her peers across Enron. Never going to somebody's boss and saying, can I borrow Thomas? But going to Thomas and saying, can you give us like 10 hours or 5 hours or whatever to help us? Within a period of months, she had a virtual team of about 200 people working on this project in Enron. 2 months before they were going to go live, and this was going to change the core business of Enron, 2 months before they went live, they told the chairman and the CEO what they were up to. And Ken Lay, the chairman, celebrates this as the spirit of Enron, that he was the last to know, literally. That business is today probably, and somebody will probably find an exception here, but it's probably the single largest business in the world on the web. It is doing $1 billion of transactions per day. You can't even find Dell and Amazon and Cisco against that kind of a standard. And what I find the most incredible about it, and I take a fair amount of space to talk about it in my new book, is that I believe that it is the activists in companies that are going to create the future. It is not the old guard, right? The monarchy is not, the revolution doesn't usually start with a monarchy when you think about it in most places. And I think it's interesting that we know this when we look at the world around us. We know it's Nelson Mandela and Susan B. Anthony and Martin Luther King and Vaclav Havel and Mahatma Gandhi. But somehow we've not yet taught our own people that you can change the world with your bare heart, right? And so I think we're going to learn that, and you're going to see us help creating organizations that are Louise-friendly, so you don't have to have the patience of Job or, you know, the political skills of Machiavelli to make this kind of thing happen. A consulting experience that has made my draw job, whatever you were trying to say there.
That too, yeah.
That too. I think in the work that Strategos does with companies large and small, the thing that I am continually amazed by is what happens when you go to so-called ordinary individuals and organizations and you tell them you're the ones that are going to invent the future. When you literally learn how to exploit return on imagination. I mean, Again, I don't want to give you some advertisement for what we do. That's not why I was here, but it is a, there's a philosophy underneath it. We're just right now working with one of the big pharmaceutical companies, and we will have involved over 7,000 people collectively in helping design the strategy and the future of this organization. And it's the antithesis of an elitist, you know, substitute brains. Our smart consultants will go sit in a room somewhere and come back and tell you when we have an answer. And what surprises me again and again is the enthusiasm and the imagination and the passion of people to actually have a share, a voice in setting the destiny of the organizations to which they're devoting their lives. And, you know, the one thing I've learned about the Silicon Valley is the SVP running yesterday's hot company is almost for sure not the person who's going to invent tomorrow's cool thing. But yet the way we organize innovation and strategy development and consulting so often assumes that it's that elite that is going to find the future for you. And in my experience, it just almost never happens. So that has been the most fun I've had over the last few years, is being able to go back and point to a $300 million revenue stream that started with a 29-year-old Asian-American secretary. Being able to point to a guy who is driving a forklift truck who came up with a radical new way of exploiting a company's core competencies. And, you know, I believe that, that is the challenge for all of us over the next decade or two. You know, for years we said to our employees, bring your brain to work, but the only thing we wanted them to do was to figure out how to answer the phone 30 seconds faster in the call center. Well, my view is we can ask them to bring not only their brain to work, but their imagination to work and help us, help all of us find all those cool new opportunities that are just over the horizon. And when you see that in action, it's pretty cool.
So we'd like to thank again Professor Gary Hamel, author of Leading the Revolution, Ken Hausman, Managing Director of Mentor Venture Partners and OSPI Ventures, the Harvard Business School Association of Northern California for co-sponsoring this event, and for all of you for attending and being a part of the question and answer session. This concludes this program of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley.
All right. Thank you.